City FM is the award-winning community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. BC FM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The BBC censoring whistleblowers, the very people who can tell us about corruption, secretly banned from the BBC. We talk to former Uzbekistan ambassador, supporter of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, and blogger Craig Murray. Plus this week, students across the country have been demonstrating in London about debt and privatisation of our universities. We hear from the Bristol University crew. And the week before the Leveson inquiry comes out, we also ask about close links between Lord Leveson himself and the Murdoch family, and also from Canadian Professor Anthony Hall about the too close relationship between police and media in many parts of the world. As ever, Martin Summers takes us on a tour also of the world's hotspots, and some of the were international stories. So we'll start this week, Martin, with a fascinating little email report that came out about emails relating to the death of Bin Laden. What they're saying is essentially very few people actually witnessed the drop of Bin Laden's body from USS Vinson, which is where it was supposed to have been buried. He was supposed to have been buried at sea. In fact, only a handful of very senior people, no sailors on the ship, were allowed to witness it. This all sounds a little bit bizarre. It sounds like, you know, we thought that the ship would have been there, but they weren't. Basically, there was only one or two people there.
Well, I mean, this is Associated Press that have uncovered this through a Freedom of Information request, I understand. But there are all sorts of other discrepancies in the Bin Laden story. I mean, alarm bells should have been ringing from the beginning when the government can't come out with one single story about what happened. He was armed, he wasn't armed, we shot him in the head, no we didn't. We've got eyewitnesses on television in Pakistan saying that what happened was completely different from what we've been told. And it's definitely established as a fact that the live feed, which had Hillary Clinton and Obama watching live to the actual attack,
yes, I can remember a photograph. I remember a photograph. Yes. It was almost taken from behind the screen, wasn't it? Yes. Of all these famous people in the US.
And then they later had to admit that in actual fact they'd staged the photograph because there was no live feed with the attack. What many people in Pakistan believe, and of course people in Pakistan tend to be better informed about this than many people in Middle England, is that Bin Laden's been dead since 2001.
Okay, what evidence? What evidence is there for that?
People who want to check this up, they should check up General Hamid Gul, G-U-L, who used to be the head of the ISI during the 1980s during Operation Cyclone. He is fairly convinced that Bin Laden died in Tora Bora. Now, you may say, well, who the hell is he? Well, he's the head of the Pakistani intelligence services, somebody who's likely to know a little bit more than your average Daily Express pundit.
But hang on a minute, the Pakistani ISI is one of the most notoriously dodgy services in the world.
Fibs, yes, but do you think MI6 and the CIA don't tell fibs? Everybody's telling fibs. The question is, who's telling fibs?
Well, one of the things that certainly concerned me about this was seeing that that actually Bin Laden, around about the time of the 9/11 attacks back in 2001, actually had quite a serious kidney condition.
Indeed. And of course, the French Secret Service leaked to Le Figaro. And it was
that's a French newspaper.
This is the French Daily Telegraph, saying that in November 2001, they leaked information from the French Secret Service, briefing by the French Secret Service to the French press, saying that the CIA station chief in Dubai had visited Bin Laden in hospital on July the 4th, 2001, to visit him and wish him a speedy recovery from his operation that he'd had in the American hospital there. Now, we've got a clear situation there where the French Secret Service have briefed one way, and the CIA said, no, nonsense, of course our guy didn't go and visit Bin Laden. So the CIA say one thing, the French Secret Service say another, Pakistani Secret Service say another. Now, what people have got to realise out there in Radio Land is that they could all be lying. Don't presume that what the British government or the American government tells you is the truth. These people are all professional liars.
It certainly looks as if he certainly had this kidney condition. I mean, that almost, you know, there's very little doubt about that. Yeah. Obviously, if you're in a cave in Tora Bora or wherever you are, it's not going to be very easy for you to survive on dialysis if that's what you need, which is what it was shown that he needed at the time.
The point is that senior military in both Pakistan and Russia have long disbelieved the whole story of 9/11 and bin Laden. Ordinary people in Britain need to understand that maybe the story is as the CIA and the British are telling it, but the Russian and Pakistani general staff don't believe a word of it, and they have their own spies and they have their own sources of information.
What about generally then about 9/11? If bin Laden, you know, why would, you know, stories be made up about bin Laden? Why is it possible that a whole kind of, I mean, you know, obviously he's a terrorist bogeyman, that he may be useful as that, but why say that he was killed when he was, when actually maybe he died earlier on? What's the purpose?
Even Republicans in the US are questioning this and saying, well, it's Obama's trying to get re-elected, isn't it? Now, I don't really know the true story behind it. Frankly, I just do not believe a word they say. Eyewitnesses on the scene in Abbottabad said that in actual fact there was a crash of a helicopter in which Navy SEALs all died, and then all the Navy SEALs that were involved in the assassination of bin Laden all died on a helicopter crash in Afghanistan, which was when it was shot down by the Taliban. So all of the witnesses to what actually happened, they just happened to be on a helicopter in Afghanistan, and they're all dead now. And I just say, well, I just don't believe in any of this, frankly. And I have to tell you that most educated people in Pakistan don't believe a word of it. And that's not because they're stupid. It's because, in actual fact, they just have a different view of the world from people in Britain who just go, well, the government said he was there. In Pakistan, they don't believe
that. Okay, if you don't believe that story, what do you believe?
I don't know what I believe. What I first thing I say is I don't presume to know what I don't know. And I don't believe what governments tell me. But the fact of the matter is that the Russian general staff are fairly convinced that 9/11 was an inside job. And about 9/11, I keep pointing out the two salient facts that people need to get their heads around. There was a third building that collapsed at 5:30 in the afternoon, WTC-7. People can look it up with a search on the computer. No plane crashed into it. So the plane pancake theory collapse simply won't wash with WTC-7. The other question I'd like people to ask themselves, where was the United States Air Force for an hour and a half during the most serious attack on the United States ever? In the 1940s, it took 5 minutes for British planes to get airborne after...
What they've said is that there were exercises going on that day, and that's why they weren't necessarily prepared for a real attack. A lot of the people at NORAD, the Air Defence Set Network, actually believed that this was part of an exercise,
confused. An exercise of planes crashing into buildings was going on exactly the same day when planes crashed into buildings. Do you know what that does? It sets an alarm bell ringing. But I think what people need to do is just check General Ivashov, Leonid Ivashov, who's the commander of the Russian armed forces on that day. He's absolutely clear, very calm, that was an inside job, we know, and basically we're making our plans accordingly. That's the reality out there, folks.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, Petraeus Benghazi Gate, the new Watergate moment that may shatter Obama's presidency. This is an article by one of our... He's becoming almost a correspondent, isn't he? Richard Cotterill, who's a former Bristol and South West Conservative member of the European Parliament. He's a contributing writer for a website called End the Lie. With each passing day, the unfolding saga of Petraeus Benghazi Gate displays ever more surprising turns, which indicate a huge cover-up at the heart of the American state. Well, one thing I've picked up on, which has also been broadcast on the national news and the mainstream press, Martin, is that General Petraeus, who was in charge of the Central Intelligence Agency at the time of this attack on the US embassy in Benghazi when the ambassador was killed, he has actually refused to testify, hasn't he? And he's basically resigned.
He testified in secret, I believe, the other day. As a result.
So they've forced him to testify, but it's in secret.
Yeah, but obviously it's quite hard to read the entrails of what's going on here. The most sensible thing I've read about this was from James Petraeus. Petraeus
from the man himself.
No, yeah. Petraeus is P-E-T-R-A-S, and he's a professor in New York. Basically, we may see Petraeus as a sort of gung-ho, jingoistic warrior character, but he actually said some very harsh things about Israel not long ago, saying that, you know, they'll have to, we shouldn't just run our policy around Israel. Petraeus has been very much associated with the arming of the jihadi groups in Syria and in Libya, which has long been Western policy, of course. I mean, the Islamic Fighting Group of Libya is Al-Qaeda Libya, we trained them, we work with them, we're working with them now. And he's been associated with that. The Israelis are not so keen on the support for those groups. So Petraeus, and Petraeus's reasoning, Petraeus has been removed because of his absolutely, you know, his 98% support of Israel as opposed to 100%. But for one thing I will say without fear of contradiction, I hope, Petraeus has not resigned because he had an affair with somebody, not his wife. That's not why CIA heads resign. And if you think that's why CIA heads resign, I have a bridge to sail you.
Okay. So what were the possible motives? I mean, if Petraeus was involved in some way and the CIA were involved, I mean, how would they do that? This is the question of the killing of the US ambassador in Benghazi. What possible motive could there be for one arm... Just let me finish, Martin. For one arm of the US state to actually be involved in the killing of another arm, which is this ambassador chap.
Well, the reality is that there was an election going on with Obama and Romney as the two head-to-heads. Obama needed to be made to look as if he was incompetent. Just as Obama possibly faked the Bin Laden incident so he looked as if he was in charge, the Benghazi incident makes him look as if he's not in charge. Go figure, folks, yeah? Who would have an interest in that? That would be Romney and his Israeli backers.
So is it feasible that someone like Petraeus would have influence with the armed jihadi gangs in Libya?
Yes, that was Petraeus's particular speciality. When he first came to prominence in Iraq, when he got the awakening movement to switch sides from the Sunni insurgency to working for the Americans. And of course, the CIA and MI6 have been working with jihadis all along. Didn't people realise? We're chasing around the planet trying to catch them, and in actual fact, they're working for us. That's what's been going on all along.
What about the... I mean, we heard a bit about Libya last week, didn't we, about the potential motives, financial motives behind, the attacks on Libya and the West and NATO supporting the overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi. What about the situation in Libya now? What do you know about that? Because I know, for a start, there are quite a lot of armed gangs around. There have been killings going on. One of the heads of one of the police in one of the big Libyan cities was murdered outside his house a few weeks ago. It does seem as if the country isn't quite stable yet.
Well, let me turn the question around. What's happening in Yemen? What's happening in Iraq? Oh, people are being killed, people are being assassinated, bombs are going off, but we're not thinking about them at all, are we? Why aren't we getting all worked up about the terrible government in Yemen that's got to be stand down or something's got to be done about it? That terrible guy running Yemen, can you remember his name? I've forgotten his name. Can you see how the Western media shapes our perceptions of what is important to care about? Libya is still on our radar, but only just when an American dies. Syria is very much on our radar, the terrible, terrible Syrians. But Yemen and Iraq, nothing to say. Nothing happened. But in actual fact, what's going on in Yemen and Iraq is exactly similar to what's going on in Syria. People are killing each other. Car bombs are going off. Assassinations are occurring. And we're told to worry about certain places where these things are happening, and other places we're not told to worry about them at all.
I mean, if I can drag you back to Libya for a minute, a Republican, Peter King, said last week that the CIA knew that Benghazi was a terror attack right from the very start, and that they'd said that they didn't realise it was to begin with.
Well, what we've got here, fascinatingly enough, is an infight within the Western security establishment. That's what looks like what's going on. And of course, all we can see from behind the blanket is, you know, screams and punches, but we don't know who's punching who about what.
Okay, now to our next story. Turkish generals are angered by Kurd militant testimony. This is the Ergenekon trial, the famous or not so famous Ergenekon trial. First of all, Martin, as a sort of fundamental thing, this is massive news in that part of the world, certainly in Turkey, enormous, one of the biggest stories ever. And yet we've heard virtually nothing about it here.
No, it's Syria. Assad. We don't want to hear about Turkey. Turkey's been attacked, you know, by Syrian rebels. No, it wasn't Syrian rebels, it was the Syrian army. No, in actual fact, this is a very big story, because the Turkish army is absolutely integrated into NATO. Their chaps go to Sandhurst. And it turns out that they were plotting coups all along. And not just plotting coups, the way they were plotting their coups was fascinating. It was NATO's standard practice, which is to set up terrorist groups, left-wing terrorist groups, right-wing terrorist groups, Islamist terrorist groups, nationalist terrorist groups, have them blow things up and kill people and say, oh, this is terrible, the army needs to take over, and then the army takes over. That's exactly what happened in 1980 and several other times in Turkey. And now you've got a democratically elected government in Turkey that finally got to the bottom of it and sent all of their generals to prison, not just for trying to plot a coup, but as terrorists, as the terrorist masterminds inside Turkey. And they are all top NATO generals. Is the penny beginning to drop out there in Radioland who the real terrorists really are?
Well, the Turkish general was told a court this week that the 1980 coup was appropriate. Turkey's former president and 1980 coup leader Kenan Evren told a court in Ankara on Wednesday this week the bloody revolution he helped orchestrate in 1980 was appropriate for the country, as he testified via a video link from his hospital bed, challenging the authority of the court for even trying them. Two surviving chiefs of Turkey's 1980 coup rejected all charges, saying they made the appropriate choice for the sake of the country. Asked about the executions of their opponents, ex-president Evren said they showed they were not taking sides by hanging both leftists and rightists.
Both of whom were their puppets. Now, what happened in 1980 is that Turkey imposed the very first IMF structural adjustment programme, and they did it after a military coup led by the NATO-led army. But in the run-up to the coup, the Turkey was plagued by several years of terrorism. Left-wing terrorism from Devrimci Sol and from the PKK, right-wing terrorism from the Grey Wolves, who were implicated in the assassination attempt on the Pope, and Islamist terrorism, such as the attack on the British Embassy when Bush was visiting Britain a few years ago. But it turns out, in actual fact, all of this terrorism was being orchestrated by Turkey's army, and then the army was saying, oh, you need us to stop the terrorism. And that is how it works. It's how it works in Turkey with Ergonekon. It's exactly how it worked in Italy and Greece with the strategy of tension. NATO is a terrorist organisation. Ask the Russian general staff. Ask the Iranian general staff. Ask people who know. Ask the Pakistani general staff. Of course, they are all terrorists as well. Hey, it's a scary world out there, isn't it? The people who are supposed to protect us are all terrorists. What are we going to do about it?
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, one of the things we're going to do about it is institute new secret courts. The Daily Mail's been running a campaign against this. And we heard this week in the House of Lords from two people, MI5's former chief, Lady Manningham Buller, and then you'll hear after that Lord, I mean, he's got a great name. It's spelt P-A-N-W-I-C-K, but it's pronounced Lord Panic. And this is about some new procedure which is being brought in a new Act of Parliament, which is being scrutinised by the Lords at the moment, called Closed Material Procedures. So we start with the former boss of MI5, Lady Manningham Buller.
It's deeply distressing to me and to my former colleagues to be accused of really wicked iniquities in the case of torture and maltreatment. We have not been able to defend ourselves.
Judicial decisions are respected precisely because all the evidence is heard in open court and it can be reported, subject to exceptions, and judges give a reasoned judgment which explains their decision.
So anyway, that was Lord Panic there, and before him, Lady Manningham Buller in the House of Lords this week, talking about this whole concept of closed material procedures, which MI5 and the government want to bring in, which are basically secret trials, Martin. Now, Lady Manningham Buller there was saying that basically MI5 are not able to defend themselves, because if evidence was to be made public in an open court, then that would compromise national security.
Well, that's what they would say, that, wouldn't they? The fact of the matter is that these generals have been sent to prison in Turkey by open courts with evidence openly presented. Not secret trials, open trials. And that should be the same for terrorists, whether they've got an army uniform on or they're wearing a hijab. You know, the fact of the matter is secret justice is no justice. Guantanamo is an insult to the intelligence of the world. And, of course, once you've got secret trials and secret courts, then all kinds of skullduggery can be carried out by the intelligence services without any check or balance at all. We saw in Northern Ireland, the police service of Northern Ireland now, supported by both communities, hopefully, and it's not going to be sending people to prison by secret courts.
But Martin, several trials have now collapsed. Compensation has had to be paid by the government because the MI5 cannot put, this is the Internal Intelligence Service, cannot put forward evidence because then it would compromise their whole operation. Well, I mean, surely there's some sense to that.
No, they've got, what we need to do in fact is abolish the entire existing security structure and reconstitute it on a new basis. What do you think they're doing in Egypt and Turkey as we speak? The people who used to run it are all collecting their P-45s and the new lot are being brought in and they've got to work on a totally different basis. There's a rule of law or there isn't a rule of law. And if there isn't a rule of law, the terrorists who may in fact be in the government government structure are protected. That's why we have independent courts. Yeah. That's the purpose of them.
Lady Manningham Bull is a former Director General of MI5. The present one is a guy called Jonathan Evans. Now, you might like to think that Jonathan is much better at the job than she was, possibly, if she's unable to put forward evidence to show that they haven't been aiding torture in the past. And Jonathan Evans is the guy, wasn't he, that just before the London Olympics basically came on to national TV saying that G4S were doing a wonderful job and gave them a clean bill of health. Now, at the time, it was quite clear to anybody that is in the know that G4S were not in the clear, and that G4S were making an absolute dog's breakfast of the job, as we now know in a story which lasted for something like 6 days at the top of the bulletins before the Olympics. So why would the head of MI5, who's in charge of protecting us from terrorists here in Britain, why would he say that G4S were up to the job, doing a fine job? Why would he actually bother to come on TV and say
that? He's hoping to get onto the board of G4S when he retires from MI5, but the other thing he also said is that the only real threat is coming from the Iranians, and I can't see any threat coming from the Iranians. Why would the Iranians threaten the Olympics? They're being threatened with attack by the Israelis and the Americans. An attack on the Olympics would be suicide and stupidity for them. Now, what the problem we've got is that the intelligence services, including CIA, MI5, MI6, French Deuxième Bureau, the FSB in Russia, they are always out of control. And ultimately, when you have revolutions like the one you're having in Turkey or the one they may have in Egypt, you suddenly find out what's really been going on. And in actual fact, an awful lot of terrorism is rooted in these intelligence services. MI5, by and large, are, as I would see them, as a glorified plod. So they're not really necessarily in the loop. But on the other hand, that's why we have independent courts and why the police service of Northern Ireland was set up, because we can't just have the secret services running things. They are corrupt, not just corruptible, they are potentially the major source of corruption. They could be the main source of terrorism.
But Martin, I go back to Jonathan Evans. It is his job as director of MI5 to know what the terrorist threat is to the Olympics. He called it completely the opposite of the truth, didn't he?
I see him as basically somebody not to be taken seriously when he said G4S are doing a proper job, which we knew was not to be the case, and that the Iranians are the only threat to the Olympics. I thought, well, you clearly aren't up to the job. Let's get rid of you.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, one of the problems, of course, is finding people who are on the inside to talk about these sorts of organisations. One person who was a former diplomat and ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray. And he gave a talk recently over in Germany at one of these diplomatic conferences about his relationship with the BBC. Martin, first of all, let's just roll out this whole concept of the whistleblower, because he was a very, very highly placed person. He was, in fact, also the head of maritime law at the Foreign Office. He'd done a fantastic career, and yet he wasn't prepared to sanction evidence that was being supplied to the government in London from Uzbekistan, which had been obtained under torture. Well, why was that?
Well, I mean, Uzbekistan is one of those places we don't hear about, unlike Syria. It's run by a pro-Western terrorist, if you like, who's very anti-Muslim fundamentalism, and a lot of the people that he was torturing and killing were Muslims. And to his credit, Craig Murray called it like he saw it, which is, this guy's a thug, what are we doing, why are we doing business with him? And that, of course, was not welcome to his superiors back in London, because as far as they're concerned, the guy running Uzbekistan's one of us. What's the problem?
So anyway, let's have a listen now to Craig Murray, former Uzbekistan ambassador, explaining how very strange dealings that he had with the BBC. To begin with, he was on the BBC round about once a week on national radio and national television, and all of a sudden, it came to a grinding halt.
Whistleblowers are a small group, 5 or 6 people in the UK, and not many more in the States, who are major whistleblowers. We all know each other, we keep in touch with each other, we meet each other, we have a kind of mutual support organisation. Virtually no one has ever managed to get a job. Some obtain more respectability than others, but in terms of ever being again in any situation of responsibility or in any regular paid employment, it's almost impossible. I still do jobbing bits of journalism. I give talks, some of which pay good money and some don't. One of the things I used to do was actually appear quite regularly on the BBC, giving commentary on various programmes, which used to pay small money, but it was helpful. And I, for 2 or 3 years after I left the Foreign Office, I was appearing in total 30 or 40 times on BBC radio or television programmes in a year, a bit less than once a week. culminating in that invitation to appear on Question Time, which was cancelled at the last moment. Since then, I've been invited. I have been keeping a count of this on my blog. I can't actually remember where the count is now. I think it's 32 times now. I've been invited onto BBC programmes. And every time, out of 32 consecutive times, I've been phoned up and cancelled before the programme happened. There have been two exceptions. One was an appearance on Newsnight to talk about the Uzbek cotton industry, where I went on, it wasn't live, it was a feature in the programme. I went in on that afternoon, was filmed, gave my interview, but although the feature ran on the Uzbek cotton industry, my bit was cut out, didn't appear. And the only time out of these 32 times I did get on was a radio programme which had a guest presenter, a gentleman called Peter Oborne, who's a very interesting journalist, I was going to say, of eclectic views. He was a guest presenter on a programme. He wanted to have me on, and he said to the BBC, I'm having Craig Murray, and if I'm not having Craig Murray, we're cancelling the show. And as he'd been announced as the guest presenter and things, he managed to get me on. Now, I do not know the mechanism. I do not know the mechanism. I genuinely don't, by which I'm banned from the BBC. I don't know how it happens that researchers or producers thinking up the guests they want to comment on a particular programme, think, oh, Craig Murray's good, somebody phones me up, somebody books me, then at some stage in the next, usually in the next 2 or 3 hours, a mechanism kicks in and I get phoned back and I'm cancelled. I don't know the mechanism used to make that happen. Somebody, not me, put in a Freedom of Information request to the BBC, which is a public body, asking for any documents on Craig Murray, on the decision to cancel him on Question Time that time, and on why he's been disinvited from so many BBC programmes since. And the BBC replied that there was an exemption under the Freedom of Information Act for matters relating to journalism, and the decision not to invite me was a journalistic decision, therefore exempt from a Freedom of Information Act request, which is fascinating, because that means, according to the BBC, censorship and journalism are identical things. So I'm merely giving my own example. And as I talk to you more, when I finish, you can ask me questions. I think you realise I actually do not have any views which are not held by quite a large proportion of the population and which are not, you know, reasonably respectable over dinner party. I do not have extraordinary views of a kind that need to be banned from the airwaves. I do have a different critique on foreign policy than the one you generally hear, a different view of government than the one you generally hear in the media, and I have, of course, a professional background that enables me to speak in that way with some authority. One thing, in my view, that happened with the Occupy movement, and I went down, I lectured at the Occupy London site, I spent time there, I met the people there. In my view, the media were actually deliberately cherry-picking people from the Occupy movement as spokesmen, precisely because they appeared to be rather inarticulate, disorganized. Or that's one of the problems with something like the Occupy movement, which has a philosophy of not having leaders and not having official spokesmen. Because when you're an organization and you do have an official spokesman, you choose someone who's good at it. And I have no doubt, in some interviews I saw, that the but people from the Occupy movement were being put up by the media's representatives in the knowledge that that person was not up to the job. And that's why that person was selected by the media.
Well, quite a lot to talk about there, Martin. Craig Murray really tells it like it is. Someone who was a former British ambassador and a blogger now, because he's not really appearing on the BBC. I suppose that's the most concerning thing. 32 times there, Martin, he's saying he's been phoned up by the BBC. He's been ready to, in, sometimes even sitting in a cab on the way to the BBC, including onto a Question Time programme. And then he's phoned up halfway there or before he's even got in the car and gone somewhere and told, oh, it's all been cancelled.
Well, as he said, he doesn't quite understand what the mechanism is by which this is happening, but clearly something is happening, and that's what people need to realise. That's why you need BCFM, folks.
Okay, and also blogs, craigmurray.org.uk, I think is his address. Now, Craig actually did play quite a big part in the downfall of our local MP, who was Defence Secretary Liam Fox, didn't he?
Well, you'll have to remind me what exactly.
Well, over
was.
His articles about this guy Adam Werety, and also yeah. His professional understanding of the law as regards to foreign affairs.
Yes, I mean, and clearly Craig is a man of principle. and some people don't like men or women of principle, and they have a hard time. But all power to his elbow, eh?
But what about this problem with finding it impossible to then get paid employment? I mean, you would think that someone who's a whistleblower should be better treated both by the BBC and also by future employers.
Well, don't forget that these people, the powers that be, want to discourage people from taking stands about things that that upset them. So these people have to be punished and seem to be punished, so that anybody else who's still inside the structure, who might have any ideas of spilling a few beans, realises what the consequences will be. And that's the purpose of the whole charade.
So are you saying that even though there is even now legislation in there to protect whistleblowers, actually at the end of the day, if you are, it's almost like a sort of big black mark against your name and you're never going to work again?
Well, it looks that way, doesn't it? But truth will out.
What about the what he was saying about the Occupy movement there? Because that's quite a serious allegation, and a fascinating one as far as I can see, that some of the ideological structures of groups like Occupy, who see the rest of society as, and political parties, for example, the churches maybe, as too hierarchical and are trying to flatten their structures. What he's saying is that the media are really taking advantage of that and picking people who are actually not very articulate to be their spokespeople.
Well, it's quite clear that's what's going on. I mean, Fox News were definitely doing it in the US. It's a problem, and what you've got is a whole new generation coming to politics. And we'll perhaps be talking about that in a moment with some of that younger generation. And the tactics of the past obviously need modifying, but some of the lessons of the past have to be learned, which is that if you do have no hierarchy at all and no spokespeople, well, the media will choose your spokespeople for you, and they won't choose the right ones.
Do you think what about the actual ultimate question, though? Do you think that Occupy are right to have this whole sort of no leaders policy, to say everyone is the same in Occupy?
Well, at the end of the day, the media can always go and pick on anybody they like and poke a camera in their face, can't they? I think it's all a learning curve. I think the idea of having a less hierarchical structure is a noble one, and it's one we've been struggling with over the years in the progressive movement. I mean, the Greens, for example, have had a load of struggle about whether they were going to have a leader at all. But ultimately, in the modern media-led, social network-led, if you like, revolution that we're in, you've got to have articulate people to put your case, because otherwise you come across as inarticulate.
Well, what you seem to be saying, though, is that this whole thing of having a flat structure with no leaders just simply doesn't work.
No, it can be made to work in certain circumstances, but it's jobs for circumstances, isn't it? When you're dealing with the media, it won't work for that. You need to actually say, right, we're going to be professional about the way we deal with the media if we're going to get our message over.
Okay, so you have a flat structure, but you do have a hierarchy with one person spokesperson.
What you do is you have tools designed for specific jobs.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, it's been a big week for students across the country. Many of them have been protesting in London, mainly to do with student debt, but also about the slow privatisation of large parts of our education system. And from Bristol University, I'm joined by Jamie Melrose and Tim Saunders now. Hi, Jamie, first of all, and welcome to Drive Time.
Oh, hi.
You're Tim.
I'm Tim, not okay, Jamie,
sorry. Got you around the wrong way. Tim, tell us what you've been up to this week, then.
Well, this week, from last Wednesday to this Thursday, we had a week of action at Bristol University looking at what problems we face partly because of cuts, partly because of an increasing culture of managerialism and privatisation in education. This wasn't just in Bristol, but universities all across the world were doing stuff this week. There were strikes in Quebec, protests in Germany, and as far away as Thailand.
Okay, so tell us what's happening, because this really didn't figure very much on the news yesterday. How many people were in London, and why were they there?
Okay, in London there were about, according to mainstream media, 3,000 people. According to the student union, 10,000. So probably somewhere in between that.
Okay. Now, first of all, you're talking about student debt. Now, I realise for many young people who may have voted for the first time in the last general election, if this was like, hey guys, this is your introduction to politics, is a kick in the teeth, basically, because many young people voted for the Lib Dems, because the Lib Dems were standing on a platform of abolishing tuition fees, and then everyone found out afterwards, oh, hang on a minute, David Cameron's done a deal with Nick Clegg before the election that actually, if they go into coalition together, they're going to do the complete opposite. So how do you think students react to that as their first taste of politics and, you know, voting in a general election?
We saw very clearly how they reacted in 2010 when the vote was coming in. People were very, very angry and were willing to show it and willing to do it outside of the political system if they had to.
And what about, what do you mean by that? I mean, when you say outside of the political system, what other avenues are open?
Well, there was, as we all know, what happened at Millbank. There were in the universities there are a number of occupations in the colleges and schools around the country, and especially in Bristol there were walkouts and protests, and of course there was the big protests in London in which people stopped protesting completely peacefully, stopped protesting legally, and took the streets for themselves.
And also, a lot of people saying that that there were people in other parts of the world that saw British students on the streets of London and took inspiration from that as one of the many ingredients that started off the whole process of the Arab Spring as well. Also, there is this spectre of privatisation as well. Can you just tell us, I mean, Bristol University, surely they're not privatising that?
Well, I think my friend Jamie knows a little bit more about it than I do.
OK, Jamie, let's introduce you. This is Jamie Melrose.
Hello, thank you very much. I think one of the most interesting and salient facts ever uttered by our Vice-Chancellor, Eric Thomas, a Vice-Chancellor, for those people who don't know, is effectively the chief executive of the organisation, is to say quite candidly that the government's current programme of university reform will lead to privatisation. He says that. It's not like he's denying the fact. It's not like he's trying to hide the fact. He will openly say that these current reforms are all about privatising university and commodifying education.
But I'm sure Eric's looking at the balance sheet, the national balance sheet, and he's saying, well, look, if this university is going to survive, we need to start taking private sponsorship, private money.
Absolutely. And, of course, the important point there, if one looks at the London School of Economics, for example, is that much of that private money is not transparently made clear to people where it's coming from and who's giving it.
So what kind of institutions are the likely to be investing in your university in the future, you know, contributing towards your lecturers' paychecks?
Well, actually, right now, the university has signed a contract with BA Systems, with Santander Bank, and is one of the Santander universities. They're called already. Students are getting their fees paid by the bank because they can't afford to do it themselves. They're forced to. Likewise, also we've heard that, we don't know how many, but we know that because the statistics weren't available even after a Freedom of Information request, but we know that some students are already getting their fees paid by BA Systems, which I'm sure people have talked about on your radio show before, who are very corrupt and very involved in the arms trade.
Well, we do. Yes, we do. We have quite a lot of discussions about BAE, who organise these sort of dodgy arms deals where bribes are paid through kind of official routes in a way. And there have been many, in fact, several now, big national prosecutions by the fraud squad into BAE Systems, which have, for political reasons, it seems, been dropped over the last few years. But surely a company like BAE is quite entitled to sponsor young people through university because they need good graduates.
Yep, they do. And that's but what's happened is the introduction of fees has meant that people are forced to rely on these companies. They can't get into university off their own back anymore, and therefore it's given people like horrible people like BA Systems a way in order to force people who can't afford to go to university to work for them.
Also, Jamie, your point about Santander sounds quite fascinating. The idea that because these student loan companies are now so essential for every young person that's going to university, that they're starting to sort of appear as their logos are starting to appear around the place, and that they're actually starting to get involved in the running of the place. But, I mean, surely people like Eric Thomas are going to be saying, hang on a minute, this is your Vice-Chancellor you mentioned, it's that actually we are running university, not Santander.
Well, I don't think that's entirely honest, either with himself or with the people who are listening to him, because we all know that money talks, and if universities are competing with one another, then they're going to be competing with one another for various contracts and for various revenue from various companies. So obviously they're going to sell themselves to the highest bidder, and while they may comfort themselves late at night in their beds with the thought that I'm running the university and I have the final say, and companies after all aren't going to really dissuade them from that bit of delusion. Ultimately, if you're going to try and win a contract, and we know this is how the private market works, then you're going to do exactly what it takes to get that money.
Tim, it still sounds a little bit frightening. It's almost like slowly but surely private interests taking over what should be, you know, an institution where people are going along to learn for its own good, and then actually deciding what they want to learn, and also having professional professors and other academics deciding on what the structure of a course is. Are you a little bit worried that maybe these big companies are going to start actually interfering in the kind of course structures, or is that already happening?
Not that I know of, but I'm sure they will. But I do think, though, it is scary what's happening. We shouldn't pretend that education in the UK has always been democratic. It hasn't. It's always been more affordable for the rich. Working class people have always had a much worse deal in education, and we shouldn't pretend
that. Well,
that's
why?
Been... Why? Because private schools are always better, and that people who are rich can afford to go to them. People in more middle class areas often have better quality education as well in their schools.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is back on the mic again now. Mike Martin, this movement, which seems to be being embraced by Eric Thomas, the Vice Chancellor at Bristol University, towards more involvement of private industry, surely it's inevitable.
I think what's interesting is the two companies concerned, BAE Systems and Santander, are not, in fact, private companies, if you think about it. Where does most of their final demand come from for BAE Systems? Oh, it would be government money in Saudi Arabia and Britain and everywhere else. But, of course, it's not government money that's accountable. It's government money that's unaccountable. Santander are a Spanish bank which collapsed 3 years ago, I seem to remember. And who rescued them? Oh, it would be the taxpayer. So what we're actually getting is the use of taxpayer funds for private interests capturing the whole structure of universities, and then what happens after universities and so on. And I think our friends here have put their finger very closely on what is going on, and I understand you're saying your vice chancellor is being honest about this. Are other vice chancellors being less honest about it? Is Bristol, you know, forging ahead and being seen to be the privatisation, I don't know, frontrunner, as it were?
Mecca. A mecca of privatisation. Is that the case, Tim?
I can say that Eric Thomas is the chair of Universities UK, and so he speaks probably a lot more than other vice-chancellors.
Okay.
But it is the case that he is probably a pioneer of trying to find funds from companies rather than the state. That's definitely something he claims to be a pioneer of anyway.
And of course the line is, oh well, the state is shrinking, as we all know, this is the only game in town. But I ask, as an economist, I say, why is the state shrinking? It shouldn't be shrinking. In a crisis like this, what happened in the 1930s is that the state actually grows, an accountable state.
But I mean, this isn't...
That is actually the only way to break the back of the crisis.
But Martin, this isn't Eric Thomas's fault, is it? He's no. Actually looking at his university, saying, well, look, if I sit still here, we're going to see... I'm going to be happy to sell off buildings, sell off faculties. What I want to do is embrace this new regime and embrace private money. Otherwise, my university is going to slip down the ratings.
Yes, well, as I say, what is private money? Santander is a bank bailed out by the taxpayer, and BAE Systems gets most of its money from final government consumption, but leaving that aside, I think that we ought to have a properly funded education system, free to everybody, like they used to have in Libya, or they used to have in the Soviet Union, or they've still got in Cuba. Or when I went to university in the 1970s, I left without a penny of debt and all my fees were paid. That's the reality. And that's how it was. And of course, you've got to expand that. A lot more people go to university now than used to. And of course, it's going to cost a lot more. But you say, well, we can't afford not to have that. How do you think countries like Singapore and Finland succeed? They spend money on education. And they don't just try and scrimp it off the back of the private sector, so-called private sector. It's the takeover of elite universities like Bristol. They are seen as the prizes, aren't they, by these people. They're not that bothered about funding, I don't know, Dartmouth Polytechnic or whatever as it might be, or Dartmouth College or whatever. But as rightly pointed out by our friends here, it's very, very unfair. The education system fails at least 40% of our young people. It's not relevant to them, and they don't get... And, of course, the whole purpose of the system is to find out who are we going to stop wasting money on. So all the money is concentrated at the top on the people doing final research and all the rest of it, and people, you know, who are leaving school with no proper qualifications, well, they were never going to do much anyway, so why waste any more money on them? Very, very pernicious.
Tim, can you just give us a picture of student activism up at the university and give us an idea of some of the society parties that are around, because quite clearly, you know, there is people often think of modern students, these students nowadays, as being basically having their backs up against the wall, what with all these student loans. But I know there's quite a lot of political activity up there too, isn't there, that's independent of the university itself.
Yeah, well, the group we're part of is Reclaim Education, which was set up to try and organise this week of action. In general, a lot of stuff's being done by Bristol Amnesty, who have been like resisting the arms trade, as well as Bristol Left, who helped a lot with the week of education and also like in organising talks, trying to politicise students, trying to show them that we can fight back against this. Because ultimately, although there are obviously a number of us fighting back, a lot of students aren't getting involved, and I don't think that's apathy. What I think it is they think that they're stuck. They think there's no alternative, and we need to show them that there is, and that there's actual things we can do.
Well, Tim Saunders and Jamie Melrose from Bristol University, thanks very much for joining us this evening. On to our final item. And ever since the discovery of America, Professor Anthony Hall argues, empire has been the obsession of the Western world. Now, even though the media is taking us deep into war zones, we understand less and less what's really going on, which is in fact a series of immoral religious wars being sold to the public on the TV news as if it were a used car or a can of beans. Let's hear now from Professor Anthony Hall, the author of Earth into Property.
We live in a time where the big pollution we're dealing with is the pollution of the mental environment, the engineering of psychological conditions which facilitate invasions. Like when you think, you know, sending drones into Pakistan to attack whole communities, well, how is that possible that society allows that to happen on our behalf? We even are asked to pay for this. It can only happen if on some level we've dehumanized those people on the receiving end of the drone attacks, of the white phosphorus attacks, of the depleted uranium attacks. If we've somehow been sold a line that these are not really fully human people, they're kind of terrorist people, or their families are inclined to terrorism, or their religion is inclined to terrorism. You know, we've seen this dehumanization of populations in preparation for terrible things. We saw this in the Second World War. We saw this in Nazi Germany, where whole populations, gypsies, Jews, were depicted in the media as sort of subhuman, as scum. So when, you know, the concentration camps, when the full murder campaigns are underway, the surrounding population are willing to accept it and be complicit in it and even be involved in it. So we're seeing that with the poisoning of consciousness towards Arab people and, of course, the larger community of Islamic people. Incredibly to me, we living in the 21st century, who would have imagined that we live in a time where religious wars are being sort of sold to us? And we know on the right wing in the Bush years, Christian Zionists, you know, they tended to see the invasion of Iraq as an invasion of an infidel society. It was sold as a religious mission. And it goes back to very old themes in imperialism. I mean, imperialism doesn't say, well, we're going to appropriate resources so we can benefit a minority in the imperial capitals. You don't put it that way. You say, no, we're bringing civilization to the savages. We're bringing Christianity to the infidels. We're bringing the universal Roman Catholic faith to those who would otherwise be destined to an eternity in hell. And so this war on terror, you know, recasts and reframes these very old patterns that we've seen in history through a modern day form of psychological warfare.
Where do you see this all heading? Because it sounds like a bit of a bleak picture, and almost an unstoppable Leviathan.
Yeah, but of course, you know, this tiny minority that is monopolizing so much of the wealth, and through the instrument of control of money, able to control media, and through media, able to control perceptions. It is a small minority, and the vast majority of people who are being dispossessed, who are being abused, who are facing a prospect of our psychological environment, our consciousness is polluted. How do we move beyond that? We see in Occupy Wall Street, we see here and there mobilization of people. But let's face it, how much consciousness is left? People are dealing with pharmaceutical drugs, illicit drugs, hypnosis on television, terrible financial problems in their families, health issues, as pollution takes over. So it is a dire situation. Those of us who are conscious, who can look beyond the hypnotizing effect of the lies we are fed constantly on mainstream television and on the reprehensible BBC, which, you know, used to be credible, but now is it's hard to accept that once credible agencies could betray us at this level, this, you know, unwillingness to cover the citizens' investigation of 9/11, for instance. So because the mainstream media, because the police, because the formal investigators refused to do their job, citizens took it over, professors took it over. And so after 10 years, we've got a huge documented body of evidence now that what we saw on 9/11 isn't at all like what happened. So we can deconstruct the official version of what we were told within hours of the event of what happened, in which the state governments, the mainstream media, continue to reinforce those interpretations that we got within the first few hours. But we've had this enormous citizens' investigation. We've had the development of the internet where we can communicate. And when you see the BBC, or in my country, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, you know, just repeat this fraudulent interpretation, and it's not just a story, it's replicated every day, because each bombing or every episode that happens is put in the framework of this fraudulent interpretation of 9/11, and it's reinforced and reinforced. It creates the master narrative.
It does seem that it's quite a well-organized psychological warfare operation against the Western public. That sort of operation is not going to be embarked on if the perpetrators don't think they can win it.
Yeah, you look at the internet, and it seems to me that 9/11 is the subject of the largest initiative on the whole internet, offering a perspective on how reality is constructed, how power actually works. It's become a vast enterprise, a venture, a mission shared by millions of people around the world. And, you know, we do organize. I've been in Paris. I've been in San Francisco. I meet people who see 9/11 as an important thing. Now, you could say, well, why are we so focused on this one issue? And you could say, well, we know we're lied to all the time since we've been little children, and we see all those advertisements, and we find out when you consume this cereal or get that free this or that, you know, it's not what it appears to be. So we're conditioned to accept that we're lied to all the time. But on 9/11, this particular complex of lies is so audacious, and its consequences have been so monumental in sort of transforming global geopolitics to give unfettered power to this war machine. So many people from all kinds of backgrounds, different ideologies, have sort of converged on this idea. This is one set of lies that we aren't going to tolerate. We're not going to tolerate the BBC lying to us day after day. It's a major thing. Yes, it's maybe a small number of people in every community, but it's in every community, and it's everywhere. And I'm sure, you know, young people working for the BBC or working for mainstream media, that they can surf on the internet. And so, it's obviously a top-down kind of thing where those seeking to go up the ladder understand that it's not good for your career to be seen to be too curious about this set of circumstances on 9/11. But collectively, those of us who will speak about it publicly, those of us who just make it clear and speak to power that, you know, we know the basis of your command and control system is based on an enormous lie, an abuse of the public, a toxification of the mental environment. We're not going to stand for it. And you will be held accountable one way or other, sooner or later. I envisage a day, how long will it be when people retroactively are saying, oh, back in 2007, 2008, I realized that 9/11 was an inside job. I think the heavy lifting has already been done. I think on some level, the news is out there. I find it very interesting that public intellectuals, those who are actually paid to deal in ideas, they won't touch this. But people who are working on the internet and aren't paid, will just voluntarily mobilize and try to expose the lies and try to correct the false record that needs to be corrected. People are doing this on a voluntary basis, and it gives the movement, I think, a kind of purity. It has a grassroots integrity, and it almost has a kind of class structure. If you want contracts, if you want major access to the media, if you want upward mobility, you know you sort of avoid this subject. But the numbers who can get away with this are, I think, the...
Are you saying there's a sort of shelf life to this big lie?
Yes, it's been 10 years since 9/11, and who knows what other false flag operations might have been preempted, because just the awareness of those who might be contemplating making something blow up or making a dirty bomb go off here or there and blaming it on Iran, or, you know, going through the usual procedures of preparing psychological opinion for some invasion or attack. Who knows the reality that the 9/11 truth movement exists, and that people are on to this kind of abuse of the system, abuse of power. Who knows what false flag operations that we may have already preempted.
That was Professor Anthony J. Hall there, and his book Earth into Property looks at the roots of modern empire and how that idea has changed into the 21st century. He's from the University of Lethbridge, Alberta in Canada. Martin, really, his book essentially is about how the idea of the entire planet was a giant commons to begin with, a free gift to mankind as a whole, and slowly but surely it's been privatised into fewer and fewer hands, the rich and also corporations. It's a bit of a big scope for a book, and he focuses on the main problem now being the toxification of the mental environment that all this ownership of the media and control of the police that includes things like MI5 has brought to us.
Yes, I mean, basically it's a big book, but it's got a big theme, and I quite like big fat books like that. But you have to sit, you know, this is the weather for books like Tony's, isn't it? You need to sit by the fire and educate
yourself.
If
you can afford to pay your fuel bills, yeah, I mean, that's not such a bad idea. But ultimately, I mean, he's talking about this thing, the phrase I take from that, the toxification of the mental environment, that can only be done by complete control of the mainstream press.
Well, don't forget that psychological warfare was only invented in World War One, and of course the powers that be suddenly realised that bending people's heads was what it was all about, and they spent a lot of money on finding out how to do it.
Time to sign off now, but that's just the start of your Friday night talk radio extravaganza. Coming up now is the all-live typical topical Afro topical show. Thanks to Leslie Axana, Jamie Melrose, Tim Saunders, and next week we do it all again. You can follow my Twitter feed in between the shows at Tony Gosling, and online thisweek.org.uk. Now over to Cyrus the Virus after the Murdoch News.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, a circus owner found guilty of causing suffering to an elderly elephant has left court without any fine, ban or jail term. Bobby Roberts instead received a 3-year conditional discharge after the animal called Anne was filmed chained to the ground and being hit with a pitchfork. Jan Creamer from Animal Defenders...